Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm happy to have as my guest Zachary Mason, who I haven't seen in 7 or 8 years. He wrote a novel some of you might remember. It was called The Lost Books of the Odyssey, but now there's a book called Void Star. And I'm curious, people who are writing about it, beautiful title, by the way.
Thank you.
Refer to it almost in an automatic, a knee-jerk way as cyberpunk. Is that something you identify with?
Not even remotely. I'm not even exactly sure what it means. Bionic implants and just mirrored sunglasses. Yes, the definition eludes me. I think of it more as literary fiction that uses science fiction and genre elements. So, what's science fiction? It's usually set in the future. It's kind of about technology. Usually, it's mostly about technology. Usually, there isn't that much attention paid to the writing. Usually, it's more for an adolescent audience. I feel like Void Star is, to a large extent, about the texture of consciousness and memory and time and using memory implants and AIs and whatnot was a way to access that and a way to talk about it in a way that would have been impossible if it had been set in 1993.
Those novels by Dickens or George Eliot, where the author knows everything the character is thinking, are said to have been written by an omniscient author. Omniscient, omnifacient. He knows everything. Your novel has three major characters through whom we experience everything, from the color of lights to the quality of weather to their sense of their blood pulse. And yet we move from one to another easily. Gradually, we learn that they've had, at different stages, implants, cranial implants, sometimes thanks to an accident, that give them access not just to their own memory, but to a vast encyclopedic sense of world memory, because their implant is connected to the web.
It is the case that they can access the web, but having direct access to the web is actually kind of boring. In the same way that you wake up, you have your coffee, and if you spend too much time checking news and email, you start to have this sort of stoned, dead feeling. It's probably more interesting for them when they connect directly with each other. Like, there's a point where Rena and her friend Constantine have linked their implants so they can perceive each other's sensoria.
One of them, Constantine, is about to die, and Rena has gone to visit him. And it's at that point, when dying, she gains access to his memories. And as it is said later by, I think, his grieving father, they literally bleed into each other. And that question seemed to me to be crucial to this book. What is character? What is the barrier? Is there a barrier between self and other? And if so, would total access to memory at any point be the end of that barrier? But I would see a word I might not necessarily know, like ley line, in one chapter, presumably in one person's consciousness, mm-hmm. recur in another chapter in another person's consciousness. And so I began to suspect, well before a third of the way in, mm-hmm. that the entire novel was written by or constructed by or imagined by a consciousness that had access to all of the consciousnesses within the novel, and therefore to all of this vocabulary, and that the repetitions were hidden indications that there was a something presiding over the book beyond the possibility of human recollection or human sharing, human conversation. Mm-hmm. And indeed, that's the case, but I'm not sure it works on the level of single words of style. Now, you're a very conscious writer. Mm-hmm. Will you tell me?
So, I like your theory so much that there's no way I'm going to tell you it's wrong.
But tell me anyway. Tell me, was this kind of thing on your mind?
There's a lot of that that's deliberate. Like there are characters who appear to bear no relation to each other who actually have access to some of the same pools of memories. So you'll see vocabulary repeat. You'll see certain phrases repeat, which is meant to be noticeable and kind of strange. Like, why did the ghost on the phone and Arena use the same phrase? That's kind of bizarre. And there's actually a good reason for that, and it's structurally very important.
I'm talking, by the way, to Zachary Mason, the author of Void Star. It's a new book recently published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Now, this book takes place in the future. How far in the future would you say?
Well, so as a matter of policy, I never overtly specified, and to some extent there are contradictory cues, but it's around 2130.
Yes. Why don't you specify, and why do you provide contradictory clues?
Why don't I specify? I made that choice so long ago that my reasoning process has sort of faded. It's more interesting if it's vague. It keeps you guessing and ungrounded, and also the lack of commitment makes it easier to make up history and things about climate change and the like.
I would say it isn't vague. What's interesting about it is that it's simultaneously not committed to year, but it's constantly committing acts of precision that make the reader feel like we should be able to tell because there is so much detail suggesting that we, if we were careful, that we might be able to construct a history between the now and the future as embodied in this book. Mm-hmm. Now, there seems to have been, what, at the very least a flood, yes?
So the word climate change never appears in the book, but a lot of climate change has happened, so much so that it's not something people worry about so much as reality. And it's not that there's been a flood so much as that sea levels have risen dramatically, more than anyone expected. The ice sheets, though they're never mentioned, are gone. So a lot of coastal cities have become non-viable and turned into something like Venice or worse than Venice.
And as people are displaced from their homes, they build new homes in layers on top of the old ones, both the elegant homes and what are called in this book the favelas, after the ghettos in Brazil, where many people have lived for generation after generation. So in a sense, the book's history is involved with geology. Yes. If you dug deeply enough, you might find before the fact the answers to any of the questions you need, but the ways have been barricaded. Lights have gone out, electricity is no longer available. So the book is constructing a world in which the past cannot easily be retrieved. I found this fascinating. Now tell me, do your readers finish the book feeling as though they've gotten the answers to their questions?
I feel like they finish the book with a sense of satisfaction that the primary narrative threads have been tied up. That said, there are a lot of open questions still, which aren't really in the foreground, but they're there. There's also the fact that no character in the book ever knows the entirety of what's going on. So, like, even our best-informed protagonists have misconceptions all the way through to the end.
The book is written in short chapters. Mm-hmm. I think no chapter is longer than 11 pages, and some are only one page long. Mm-hmm. And the chapters alternate, if that's the word, between three protagonists, mm-hmm. for the most part. There are spaces where two chapters in a row will come from the space joined by consciousnesses. Mm-hmm. And that's, again, very interesting to me. And let me explain to my listeners how I read a book like this. I read a book like this by shutting off everything I know and pretending that what I know from other books is not necessarily true of this book. And so although people whose reviews I read, even people who loved the book, were saying cyberpunk, I was saying, well, no, not exactly, not really. It's more an attempt to invent a narration method that would be the consequence of the presence of artificial intelligence. What does artificial intelligence do to what humans think they know about the world and what humans think they remember, since their memories can be augmented in this book by very sophisticated implants that can tell them things convincingly that may never have happened or may never have happened to them. They may meet in the course of the book the person to whom these false memories did happen. Mm-hmm. And I found myself being fascinated. But, you know, I've got to say, I don't read a book for plot. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about that issue?
I feel like plot is secondary. On the other hand, I feel like it's a cognitive technology that works beautifully, and it's essential for holding people's interest. It's like narrative is the delivery system, and it's the poetry that's the actual content they're trying to get through.
The poetry.
The poetry.
Tell me.
What's important to me about the book is how it's written and the sense of consciousness and some more specific semantic things. I wanted to write AIs that were intelligent, but that didn't have a human shape to their minds. I feel like fiction almost always gets it wrong. The usual narratives around AI are Frankenstein, it's gone rogue and it will destroy its creator, or Pinocchio, Lieutenant Commander Data wants to be a real boy. And those are both sort of easy narrative hooks, but I suspect that if there were AIs, they'd be more concerned with pattern and mathematics, and they'd have only the dimmest awareness of and very little concern with the physical and the human worlds.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Zachary Mason about his book Void Star. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Zachary Mason about his latest book, Void Star. the story of three different people navigating survival in a world in which artificial intelligence has rendered people nearly useless. Now, the thing to know about Zachary Mason when he says that he feels that fiction usually gets it wrong is that you work in the field, insofar as such things exist, of artificial intelligence.
That's right.
Now, does artificial intelligence exist, or to what extent does it exist?
It doesn't exist, or if it does exist, it exists to the extent of epsilon, so very close to zero, if not actually zero.
Now, there are loads of people who are going to sit up in their seats. Explain.
AI gets a lot of press lately, and there are many vaunted successes, like Facebook can recognize faces and pictures, and Google's DeepMind people produced a Go playing program that beat the best Go player in the world. So those are extraordinary achievements, and they're awesome and very useful, but it doesn't actually tell us anything about cognition. And there are problems like, well, for instance, everything having to do with language and design.
One of the characters in the book has survived the death of his father,
mm-hmm.
who's the president of...
Brazil.
Brazil. Another of the important personages in the book is survived by a father who has rejected the possibilities of power. And we gradually, it's as if we're fitting together a structure much bigger than the characters in the book itself to understand the patterning of what this book is really talking about.
Oh, I see. Yeah, there are lots of mirrors. There are lots of symmetrical and analogous relationships. In a way, the book is made out of them.
Yes.
There's one recurring, very strong theme that actually everybody seems to miss is interfaces. So, like Cromwell, for instance, he uses his assistant and girlfriend Magda as an interface to the world. Like, the world only really comes to him through her. And similarly, he and Irina's other clients use her as an interface to the AIs.
Now, she is a particularly fascinating character. She has become, would it be safe to say, in some sense, post-human?
I think that's a... Well, she's human-adjacent, let's say.
Uh-huh. She's been in an accident. A part of her brain has been replaced by an implant. The implant allows her to understand and communicate to artificial intelligences.
Mm-hmm.
So she is hired by corporations who are paying very high fees because, and this is very important, in this future, the computers are making the generation that follows the computer you're working on.
Mm-hmm.
But in other words, the artificial intelligence of the computer is no longer trackable by the owner of the computer.
Yeah, there was a point when the AIs got so complex that not even the best mathematicians could understand them anymore. And so they try to find ways of approaching them and approximations and visualizations that they can use to get access to what's going on. But it never really works, or at least not for almost everybody.
I asked my guest, Zachary Mason, to read a section of Void Star, and I suggested to him that he choose either for clarity or for beauty. And he said, I could do one or the other. I'm fascinating. What did you choose?
I chose Great Dark Forward, which is actually one of the first chapters I wrote. It's one of Kern's stories.
And would you say who Kern is?
Kern is one of the protagonists. He's this kid who grew up in the favelas around San Francisco. He came as an immigrant and an orphan and completely broke. He was scavenging in one of the landfills around San Francisco and found a laptop that's about 60 years old. It's basically a successor of the X11, the one laptop per child laptop. It was designed with software that is meant to capture and hold the attention of and then educate unsupervised children with trauma and no resources. And it worked and sort of shaped Kern, and then ended up giving him access to all of the media ever recorded as of 60 years before the time this happened. And Kern, what he made of it was he decided to become a perfect warrior and dedicated himself totally to martial arts. And he was just a kid, and this is a totally ridiculous thing to do, and no doubt many adolescents have such ambitions, but his dedication was sincere, and the training materials were there, and he did nothing else, and he kind of succeeded.
Here we go. This is a section from Void Star by my guest Zachary Mason.
Chapter 44, Great Dark Forward. They fight by torchlight in Quan Lan. He sees a boxer fall with blood pouring from his mouth, get rolled out of the ring and left at the edge of the jungle. They fight without gloves. The red firelight glints on the ground glass on the fighter's hand wraps. He sees a skinny Thai boy, younger than he is, die in the ring. He's close enough to see the boy's fixed, dilated pupils. His slack mouth as the doctor, a Japanese whose short-sleeved shirt reveals track marks, pushes on his chest in vain under the watchful eyes of the victor in his corner. He sees knife matches, the crowd silent as the blades test the distance, flickering over isoclines of commitment and dread, like serpents tasting the air. And finally, the explosive attack, the arc of arterial blood. He hears bets made in Chinese, German, Japanese, English, and Thai. He sees winners paid in yuan, yen, dollars, euro, bags of cocaine, bricks of heroin, fuel cells, ancient mosaics, Buddhas, Garudas, missiles, guns. They've never cleared out the jungle. He guesses they didn't want satellites seeing in, so you can never see far, and it always seems to be dusk. Flashlights glow through the jungle's constriction, and during the day, parallelograms of sun. He haunts the tracks worn through the undergrowth between the tents, the retrofitted shipping containers, the Quonset huts that were surplus from a few wars back. Everyone ignores him, except the bar girls, who call out invitations and snatch at his wrist as he passes them by. There's a market where geckos camper over piles of damp Gucci tote bags, sparkling crystal bottles of cologne, mildewed jeans. There are cardboard boxes brimming with plastic bags of coarse yellow opium, tied shut with a twist of wire. He sees a Karen tribesman showing his 8-year-old son how to analyze opium with a portable mass spectrometer, which is oddly comforting, because it's the same model used back home by the more upmarket dealers. Burmese gunmen barking quietly over jackets of French Kevlar. Big white Americans with army haircuts and oversized watches sit at cafe tables, drinking rice liquor, smoking hash, and watching the girls go by. At night, strings of red and white Christmas lights burn in the trees and show him the way to the ring. He watches every fight, but doesn't try to get in the ring, though he has little money left. He sleeps on a thin mat in the woods, in a waste space where fragments of torn cloth flutter in the branches and the pale remnants of old plastic bags make the copse look like a burial ground. There's a girl whose name might be Lily, she speaks no English, who came to him one night of her own accord, and in the gray corpse light filtering through the trees, he marvels at the contours of her body, how an object of desire can be composed of these abstract curves and swells of tissue, the dark pucker of a nipple, the pores and hairs on the olive skin. Running his hand over her stomach, he finds he's become an anatomist and knows where pressure would bring pain. Sometimes he talks to her in English as he caresses her, and that helps a little, but then he forgets words, and there's just the release, then the slight rankness of her, the stones pressing into their bodies through the mat, and her skin against his, which seems to be thawing something. One morning he wakes alone. The copse is quiet, and the girl is gone, along with the last of his money. He lies there a while, trying to find some lingering trace of her warmth, then goes into town to look for her. He can't find her, but in a bar housed in a shipping container, there's a girl with burgundy lipstick and a matching sheath dress who looks at the girl's picture on his phone and says, "That's Lily. Lily gone home. You want a new friend?" He's at the ring when the Christmas lights come on. He's hungry, but that will have to wait. He finds the promoter, a small Thai with a laptop and decaying cargo shorts that show the boxer's scars on his shins, and says, "How do you get on the card around here?" The promoter takes him in, shakes his head, and in an Aussie voice says, "Sorry, mate, we're fell up. Try another night," and turns back.
Zachary Mason, reading from Void Star. I want to know, what is a Void Star?
It's a lot of things. In the book, it's a satellite in a video game that's the sort of ultimate destination and setting for the final boss fight. This isn't the laptop game that is Kern's school. And so it was named Void Star by the programmers who created the game as a sort of joke. It's a construct in C and C++. It's a reference to a block of memory of unspecified type, which sounds innocuous enough, but you can read it as having a sort of metamorphic significance. It's also hugely unsafe and a cause of immense volatility in programs.
Because for me, as I circled an empty space in narrative with the three protagonists, I thought that the book was itself a Void Star, that the style was introducing me to a structure that would only reveal itself once it had defined the peripheries of its own void. I enjoyed this thought very much. Does it have any truth?
It does. I feel like Void Star is a little poem in itself, and it has a lot of resonance, which I think informed the book and that you're picking up on.
I'm very glad to talk to you again. Void Star is Zachary Mason's second novel. His first, which was also discussed on Bookworm, was called The Lost Books of the Odyssey. Thank you very much for joining me.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I've been talking with Zachary Mason, author of Void Star. It's a novel published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Void Star at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Peter Cole is our...
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.